Okay, good morning, Professor Alperin. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've just discussed, the topic of this interview is the ideas surrounding replica symmetry breaking and spinning glasses from roughly 1975 and 1995. But before we get to that, I'd like to ask at least a couple of questions on background or things that led up to these. And in particular, in a recent oral history you did with the American Institute of Physics, you mentioned that you did not interact much with Phil Anderson while you were at Bell Labs. It's true that you only had one article together, but it's been quite an influential one. Can you tell us a bit what led to the genesis of that work?
I don't recall saying that I did not interact with him. I interacted with him quite a bit, but it was, you know, discussions. And I didn't collaborate with him except on this one paper, but we certainly did interact. And he was influential in my general understanding of physics, for sure. Okay, you asked about how we came to this particular question. Spin glasses were an afterthought, and so he, of course, had been working on spin glasses and thinking about spin glasses before this paper. The paper was motivated not by spin glasses at all, but by structural glasses. There were experiments by Bobby Pohl, which showed anomalies, and other experiments as well, in both glasses and also other disordered systems at low temperatures, particularly in specific heat. There was an excess specific heat at low temperatures, and also anomalies in transport, in heat transport, which we tried to explain by introducing this idea, I don't think we really originated it, but we explored in some detail what the effect of these two-level systems would be in glasses. And the two-level systems that we had in mind were perhaps something where, let's say, an oxygen atom could sit in two different positions, separated by some kind of a barrier, but not such a high barrier that it was absolutely forever separated in one or the other, but that it could quantum mechanically tunnel from one side to the other. And that's what we call the two-level system. Of course, there'd be many other levels, excited levels, but you have these two levels that would be almost exactly the same energy with a very small transition rate between them. And that could lead to the fact that they weren't exactly the same energy meant you could store energy in them if it was in a higher energy state. And at low temperatures, it could be populated, and that could give you a specific heat, and that could also interact with phonons. Let's say we could scatter from one side to the other; it would be a scattering center. It would affect heat transport as a result, and other transport properties. And that's what we were mainly interested in. Really, Phil pointed out that, you know, this could also apply not to structural glasses, but spin glasses he assumed could exist. He wasn't necessarily concerned about whether they were thermodynamic states or, you know, whether they were lasted forever or just lasted for a long time. It's just that he felt that there would be glassy like states of spins, and there could be also tunneling barriers between one state and another, and that might affect low temperature, might cause contributions to low temperature properties there. And so that was, I would say, in my mind, put in as an afterthought. I certainly was not motivated in any way by spin glasses, he included it. And historically, this paper has been cited quite a bit. It had a lot of influence, but I would say almost entirely because of its possible relevance to real structural glasses, and I don't know that it had any particular influence on spin glasses whatsoever. I've never seen particularly a reference to it in the spin glass context. So that was my, you could say that was how I learned about spin glasses in some sense, but it's not a contribution that I particularly would associate myself with.
So you had never heard of spin glasses before? Is that?
No, correct? I maybe had. I can't remember back whether that was but I had certainly never thought about, I may have heard of them, but they weren't something that occupied my interest. I was interested in a lot of other things, and that was not one of the experimental situations that I was particularly focused on. I probably had heard of it, but.
Okay. So as we mentioned, this paper has been and remains very well cited, but what was the immediate reaction to it? Was there a lot of enthusiasm? Was this a signature work at that time?
Well, there were other people who had similar ideas. I don't think it was wildly controversial, but it was, and it wasn't, some of these ideas had really been in a qualitative way suggested by Bobby Pohl. But then there were, a lot of attempts to try to see if it was right, and other experiments were done to look at relaxation properties and so forth. I don't remember it's being wildly controversial at the time. There was a question of, just what these two-level systems really were, and that's still a question. And there have been arguments, and later there were arguments that things would be quite, the quantitative description would be quite modified substantially because of interactions between the two-level systems, which we didn't think were very important. They may be at very low, and I don't think that's been really resolved. And also, it may not be universal that in certain cases the interactions may be so strong that you really have to concentrate on those random interactions much more than we would have done it. But as I've tried, I haven't really kept up on it, but as far as I can see, it remains unclear, really what's going on at a really quantitative level.
So did that work get you to be interested in spin glasses in this aftermath? And in particular, right, were you paying attention to the work that Edwards and Anderson were and
Sherry? Yes, I paid. So I was aware of that. I can sort of. So let's say. Of course, that was slightly later. So certainly I was aware of it. I never got that interested in it to really try to work on it much until later. Let's say there were a couple of papers that I wrote that at least had spin glass in the title or that were somehow were involved in it, but none of it was really related to this phase transition. Mm-hmm. Business, but there was a paper I wrote with Wayne Saslow in 1977, which was called The Hydrodynamic Theory of Spin Glasses and Other Systems with Non-Collinear Spins. And we were looking at, we were sort of assuming, there was no spin orbit interaction. We were assuming there was an overall SU2 invariance, that is to say that it would be Heisenberg-like interactions, but you had random positive and negative ones, and that it could form a spin glass, and that a spin glass, our picture of a spin glass, and it was, at low temperature, we were looking at really what happened at relatively low temperatures, but not zero temperature, but finite temperatures, but below the spin glass transition temperature, assuming there was a spin glass transition temperature, or if there wasn't a sharp transition temperature, low enough temperatures that for large periods of time, you could say this was frozen into some kind of staggered, hyper staggered array where the spins would not be aligned in any plane, but would be non-coplanar, actually just non-collinear, so all that was necessary. And then you would have something like anti-ferromagnetic spin waves, Goldstone modes, mm-hmm. but instead of two, there would be three of them. Because now you could, it would be meaningful. For an ordinary anti-ferromagnet, rotations around the axis of polarization, of staggered polarization, are unfit. They don't do anything to you, so that you don't get a new state. So there's no Goldstone mode associated with it, no broken symmetry associated with it. Here you've broken the whole symmetry. And we pointed out that it could be, that this would, lead to three Goldstone modes. And that furthermore, if you go to finite temperature, these Goldstone modes would still, they'd have renormalized velocities and there would be damping at short wavelengths, but the long wavelength, they should be undamped. So that was my venture, again, another venture into spin glasses.
If you allow me, so if I remember correctly, if I understand correctly, this work, actually this particular paper, its genesis took place at the Aspen Center for Physics during the same meeting where Anderson, Talus, and Palmer were formulating their mean field. Is that correct, or am I?
I don't.
Can you tell us about the genesis of that collaboration?
It's correct that it took place at. It is correct that it took place at Aspen, that I met Wayne Saslow at Aspen, and that's where it got started. And it, you may be right about, so let's say at that time I was certainly not aware of the collaboration between Anderson, Thallus, and Palmer, so that it might have been true, but we didn't talk about it there. So what was their paper? Was that also 77? No, what?
I think that means
yes, it was also 77. Yeah, it could well have been. It never occurred to me, but you're right they were more or less in simultaneous, but unrelated, really quite unrelated, I think. Yeah, I seem to remember Anderson being there, but I didn't talk to him about spin glasses, as I recall. But of course, this was quite a few years ago, so I may not remember that exactly right. But it's true that it did begin at Aspen.
And were you a co-organizer of that meeting, or was it a different one that you organized on the theme of disordered materials? I think.
Well, let's see. I organized a Gordon conference on disordered materials, I think in 1973 or something. That was shortly after the. I organized a conference on disordered materials with Bobby Pohl, which was a Gordon conference, I think in 1973.
Okay.
And that was following our work. So that did certainly, we were interested in that. And I did play a role in attracting condensed matter physicists to Aspen, I think in 1973, but that was a different meeting. I don't remember having a very active role in this one, but it's possible. Again, it's a long time ago. Yeah.
Sure. So one of your PhD student, just a couple of years later, right, Robert Pelkovitz,
yeah,
also worked on spin glasses during an internship at IBM.
Yeah.
Were you following his work? And did you encourage him and others or others to work in this direction or pursue this direction?
Yeah, no. So I don't recall... particularly any interactions with Bob about spin glasses. So this was now after I'd moved to Harvard, and Bob was one of my first students. But the person I had the most, my interactions with people who were really interested in spin glasses at Harvard took place later. Chaim Sampolinsky in particular was a postdoc who worked with me to some extent. I was his sponsor at Harvard. He was very independent though, and we did write a few papers together, he worked a lot on spin glasses, and I talked to him a lot. And Annette Sepelius was another postdoc there at the time who worked with Chaim, and they wrote a lot of papers together. And they were definitely interested in questions in more fundamental questions about spin glasses, about whether, you know, how you could understand them. I don't think they particularly, I don't recall them being much involved with the replica formulation that much, but they may have been. But the main thing that I talked to them about, and that they worked on, was sort of trying to understand spin glasses simultaneously or alternatively from a dynamic point of view of being, you know, sort of frozen into fractured states. And what did that really mean in terms of time, with putting in some kind of time? You'd have to think about what kind of time dependence you want to put in and how that compared with the various thermodynamic points of view. So in particular, this was after the Thallus, Anderson, Palmer, where they really, you know, said, look, there has to be some kind of real, at least in the Edwards Anderson model, there had to be a real thermodynamic transition. What happened below that is another matter, but that there really was something sharp happening, and what did it mean in terms of, you know, limits of going to infinity, and, you know, and all of that. On the other hand, Chaim was, I think, at the beginning more thinking in terms of dynamics. And for me, I thought about dynamics also, which made sense regardless of, you know. But then if you have these states which are, what do the tap states mean? Are they really long lived, or how long lived? And they wrote a number of papers connected with those things. And I, you know, I spoke to them about them. They acknowledged some discussions with me, and I made some suggestions, I suppose. But it was not, you know, so I was interested in it, but I didn't have anything creative to contribute. And I didn't, I certainly wasn't a co-author on any of those papers. I think we wrote one paper, as I looked at it, I wrote one paper with Chaim and Chris Henley, who was a student of mine, on dynamic response in spin glass with random spin orbit anisotropy. So you know, I had some interest in it, but again, that had nothing to do with, that was the dynamic. It was more closely related to the stuff I had done with Saslow than what would have been to anything having to do with replicas or spin, or the phase transition. And it also is true that in 1982, the fall of 1982, I spent a sabbatical. I was for 4 months in France, partly at École Normale, partly at Saclay. So I at that time, I don't remember in complete detail, but I think Parisi was actually there at the time, or was visiting from time to time, and De Dominicis was, I think, already quite interested in spin glasses. So I heard lectures on it, but as far as the, I'd never really got a good intuitive feel for the replica symmetry breaking stuff. And so I never had anything really to contribute to. They were way ahead of me. They had did all kinds of complicated calculations, and I could see they were doing complicated calculations, but what it really meant, I didn't have much feeling for, and it just wasn't, it was a subject that I was interested in as a spectator, but I was at that time got very interested in quantum Hall effects, and there were other aspects of disordered systems and so forth I was interested in, so I didn't.
So just getting back to the work of Chaim Sampolinsky and Annette Zipelius, so was it the context in your group or in a department that spin glasses were being discussed, or were these ideas that they were themselves bringing, or an interest, I should say, that they were themselves bringing from their prior studies? Or would you have seminar speakers come through, or reading clubs, or anything that would sort of encourage interest in this topic?
No, I don't think so. No, I think Chaim brought this. I don't think the interest came from me. I think, and I don't think anybody else at Harvard, I'm trying to think, none of the other faculty members that I can think of were particularly interested in spin glass. We might have had talks on it by Chaim, but the driving force for that, I think, was Chaim. Annette, she worked a lot with David Nelson on two-dimensional melting type thing, two-dimensional phase transitions, and that was more, I think, what she came to Harvard for, and Chaim got, I think probably it was Chaim who got her interested in the spin glass problem. But again, that sort of happened in their offices. It wasn't from me. It certainly yeah. wasn't my, I claim no credit.
And you mentioned your sabbatical in Paris. You had also been a postdoc in Paris in the 60s, yeah. where I think is the first time you met Cyrano de Dominicis.
Yes.
Had you kept in touch with the Paris physics group throughout? Were you in regular exchange or visits?
I'm not sure what the Paris physics group means.
Oh, I mean, so Cyrano, for instance, and Gérard Toulouse, and
yeah. So okay,
André so. Bonnet. So the LPS group, let's say.
Yeah. Okay. So it was different in six. So I was there at 65, 66. That was before 1968. And a lot of things were different. Cyrano at that time was, I believe, at Saclay. He gave a series of lectures on many body theory perturbation, on diagrammatic perturbation theory. At École Normale when I was there. And so, yes, I certainly met him then. I got to know him then, and I heard his lectures. That had nothing to do with spin glasses. Mm-hmm. That was
well before the idea existed.
Many body electron problems. That's how I got to know him then. I probably saw him at meetings once or twice between then and 1982. But I certainly wasn't, and I think he visited Harvard perhaps for a time also. I don't have to remember that. He was close to Paul Martin, yeah. Who was sort of my mentor originally at Harvard. So I think my contacts with Cyrano may have been more through Paul, or he came and spent some time. I can't quite remember that. Then in Toulouse, I don't even think was on the scene in 1965. I think he's a little younger. So I certainly don't remember him from then. But in 1982, then I certainly did interact with Toulouse, with Gérard, and we wrote a paper together. that was a quantum Hall, that was a quantized Hall type paper, not again. I don't remember. Talking to him about spin glasses particularly, but I do have, I spent, when I was there, I think 2 days a week at Saclay and 3 days a week at ENS. Brazin was my real host at Saclay, and I would drive out with him, and he was a good friend, really good friend, and we wrote papers together, again having nothing on wedding actually, and I certainly spoke to Cyrano then, and as I say, I also spent 3 days a week at ENS, except I gave some lectures at the Collège de France, but basically these were the two places that I was at. And I think Parisi was maybe visiting a lot at one or both of these places. So I was aware of what was going on, but I wasn't contributing.
So your student, Chris Henley, whose work you've mentioned already before, is probably the only one of your students whose work or as a dedicated thesis to spin glass problems. Can you tell us a bit how you decided to jump in more fully at that point, or to have a student?
Again, it was dynamic, you know, so it was looking at the dynamics. That's a good question. I don't remember exactly what was in Chris's thesis now. So now I'd have to refresh my memory on that one.
I mean, there was one paper with you and Chaim, and then he had two papers on his own, right, where he thanks you profusely and for your guidance. That's why I presume that you were.
I don't know. What would you remind me the names of the paper, what they were?
Yes, I can. Just give me 1 second. So there was the work with Chaim was spin resonance frequencies and spin glasses with random anisotropies.
Right.
And then the two papers on his own were computer search for defects in a three-dimensional Eisenberg spin glass and defect concepts for vector spin glasses.
Yeah. So he was certainly interested in topological defects, and that could well have been partly by influence, because at that time I had sort of recently done stuff on two-dimensional melting with David Nelson and also with others, but we were interested in more generally in defects. David was certainly interested in defects in three-dimensional materials, and so defects included for us dislocations and disclinations. So that certainly could have been part of it. David was also thinking about metallic glasses at the time in terms of different kinds of local orders, and So that would have been around a lot. To what extent I helped him, I don't remember exactly now. I mean, I was his official advisor, I was his advisor. He would have certainly spoken to me about what he was doing, and I might have helped guide him in some of that, but I don't recall. I don't recall specifically. Fair enough. But again, it was addressing these questions of, is there a phase transition what do replicas mean. There was no replica in that.
So
again, same period around when Chaim was around.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
In 1985, 1986, Harvard Physics invited Giorgio Parisi and Gérard Toulouse to give two series of Loeb lectures. I presume you were a key driver behind these invitations. First, is that correct? And can you tell us a bit what motivated your interest in bringing them at that point?
Let's see. They were friends in some case sense. I don't remember. So the way they were giving, it was Loeb lectures that they were giving. Yeah. So there's a departmental vote on the Loeb lectures. I was probably on the committee at the time, and whether I was the one who first suggested them, I don't recall. I would have certainly supported them, although they would be in competition with other people from all other fields. It could be astrophysics or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was at that time, it was sort of, as you say, it was sort of the middle of the period where it was the most actively being considered as a so I was certainly, I was not myself doing that much work on phase transitions at that point and critical phenomena, but I certainly was still aware of it, and I would have certainly been interested in what are the effects of disorder in general on phase transitions, and so I would have been certainly aware of it and interested in it. I think David Nelson would have also been perhaps influential in that, and perhaps Paul Martin also might have played a role in that, particularly since he was quite familiar with Cyrano's work and so forth. But again, it's too far back for me to remember exactly what went on at that point.
So you mentioned you following conversations about the nature of the phase transition and the low temperature phase. So in particular, were you following the work of your former students, Daniel Fisher?
Yes.
In these discussions?
Yeah. So I was aware that there was controversy, mm-hmm. as it were. Although I think the controversy had more to do with what happened with short range interactions than with. Some of the questions that one could address within the context of the Edward Anderson model, what's really going on there, where there wasn't a question of whether it was a phase transition, but the question of whether a three-dimensional system or really had a phase transition that you could understand in terms of replica symmetry breaking or not was, of course, had its own controversy. And I was certainly aware that Daniel had a different view. And I would say, I was aware of it, but he was a former student. Mm-hmm. We were not in close. I read about it more. I might have heard him talk about it, but I certainly didn't contribute to it. I would say that my inclinations were to believe him in some sense, but that I didn't have a firm view on it, and I certainly wasn't prepared to try to jump into the battle.
So this was mostly you following the literature. It's not that you were attending workshops or.
Oh, I probably, I'm sure it came up at work. No, I certainly didn't attend any workshops on spin glasses.
Okay.
But of course, talks on spin glasses might well have come up at other workshops or conferences that I attended, like statistical mechanics conferences and so forth. So, but I'd be more likely to have heard, to have read something or heard a lecture, just, you know, in a seminar series or something where it just invites people. And I, at the time, I think Daniel was probably at Bell Labs at the time, if I remember correctly, and I did consult at Bell Labs during summers. I was, you know, I visited Bell Labs relatively frequently in that period, so I might have again heard about it from him there.
Okay. During your time at Harvard or elsewhere, did you ever teach anything about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail?
Yeah. Okay. So I think the answer is no.
Okay.
I don't think I ever taught anything about spin glasses. I'm trying to think. I would doubt it. I can't think of any course that I would have taught. I tended to teach more introductory graduate courses rather than specialized courses. Occasionally I taught more specialized courses, but probably disorder was not something I really taught, even though I was interested in it.
And you worked on in many different contexts.
Yeah.
So we're about to complete the interview. So is there anything that you would like to share with us about this era that we may have skipped over, that I might have neglected?
No, I don't. I think you've covered the I think I've covered my role in it, or lack of role in it, really. I mean, part of the reason that that I didn't get that much involved in is that it wasn't that much in the way of experiment that really gets at these problems. Simulations, you can't really simulate glasses very well. I mean, I had a long experience with real glasses of how hard it is to try to answer questions about whether there is a phase transition or isn't a phase transition. I guess that kind of made me, that was something that influenced my own particular attitude in trying to look at other problems. But I recognized the intellectual interest of it, and the fact that it was in some sense a really deep problem, which like many deep problems, one may never know the answer to, but that was my view at the time. I can't really say that much about how it fit into the world, mm-hmm. the theoretical world.
Reading your AIP interview, it seems that your choice of problems, as you sort of alluded to, were closely tied to experimental problems that were manifested. Is that a general attitude that you know, American physicists tended to have more than European physicists, or that's just your own personal choice, or?
The European physicists that I interacted with in general were people who also shared this kind of attitude. I mean, when I first went to Paris, for example, I mean, I was in the group of Nozière, had a lot of interactions with Duchenne at the time. We went with to, I mean, he was very influential in Orsay, and so they were certainly, no question, but they were tuned to experiments very much. And let's see, I remember visiting Peter Fulda, who I knew from the past in Germany. These are people who were, I think they were certainly interested in experiments. So I wouldn't have made that distinction.
But Cyrano, for instance, was much more.
I think. Cyrano, yeah, there were always more mathematics. Yeah, I could point to people in the US who do mathematical physics and so forth as well. So I certainly wasn't aware of a difference between
a cultural difference, but was not.
Yeah.
Fair enough. A last question: do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
So I do. I have large files with thousands of carbon copies of papers. In those days, there was no email, so everything would have been by. There would have been carbon copies. I have these files. I haven't looked. You know, most of them are completely worthless. I don't know if any of them have to do with spin glasses. I'm trying to think. It would be very. And my expectation is that eventually they will. So Harvard is prepared to put all these things in boxes and lock them away for 50 years and then make them available. And that's probably what I would do with them. But then, of course, they wouldn't be available for 50 years is the way they would do it. I don't think I have the strength to go through and look through and see if any of them are interesting myself. Would I put them? So I'm not sure under what conditions other people can look at them in the next 50 years or not. I haven't really negotiated that with them, but of course 99.9% of it is of zero interest, and it's so
no, but it's wonderful that
you have suggestions. I don't know.
I mean, it's wonderful that you do have them. You'd be surprised at how few of these collections of papers still exist at this point. And you're right that an archive would need to index it and would need to decide what is confidential and what is not. And that is part of the discussion that you would have with Harvard if you prepare this ahead. If you actually engage in a conversation with them, which I encourage you to do. I don't encourage you to go through it, but at least to get made them aware of it ahead of.
So I've had one discussion with them, but it seemed like at least their standard policy is just lock it all away for 50 years and not worry about it. They're certainly not going to index them unless somebody actually. They certainly don't routinely index them. They don't have that much. Harvard is rich, but it's not that rich. I don't know whether in 50 years anyone would be. I suspect no one is going to be interested, but if it's, they'll be there. But I mean, if there's specific questions, I'm not sure.
I mean, if you had had a letter exchange with Cyrano, for instance, on the theme or around spinning glasses, or if you, these would be unlikely. Interesting.
I don't recall it. It would be unlikely that I would have done it.
Or with Phil, if that had taken place.
Anderson, no, yeah. The problem, you know, it's painful to write. Mm-hmm. It would be much easier. Even in those days, I could pick up a phone. Mm-hmm. Europe was even, yeah, I could have called him in Europe if I want. And if a discussion would have been much more likely to take place undocumented in front of a blackboard or, that's where all the discussions really took place, in front of a blackboard, not with,
behind a typewriter. Yes.
Typewriter. or hand, I mean, you know, if it was equations, you would certainly never have, anything that involved equations, I would certainly never have tried to do by typewriter, because that would have been far too painful. So there would be all the correspondence would have, there was very little scientific
content
correspondence. I have some of that separated, actually. I might look, but I think maybe only more recently. So typically, you know, 90% of the correspondence was about travel arrangements or letters of recommendation for some student they wanted to send me, or I wanted to send them, or that sort of thing. Very little of it would have been scientific. There were some scientific, I do have in my office, I believe, some separate files where at some point I started separating letters that had in some way to do with science, research. But I suspect that doesn't, well, I'd have to look, and I'm not in my office now, obviously, to see if any of it had anything to do with spin glasses, but I'll try to look and see if any of that, I mean, most of it had, a lot of it had to do with quantum Hall effect, because that was at the point when I started this collection. In fact, I think I separated out those that had to do with quantum Hall effect and those that had to do with all other things. But again, so this is before computers and before email, and that sort of has lapsed. I started after email, I started printing out certain things to put in that file, but now, you know, more and more I would just leave it in my computer file and assume I could search for it if I needed it.
Like we all do.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm still a little behind. I'm still in the 20th century rather than the 21st century, but at least to some extent, I'm somewhat shifting away from paper at least. Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's been
okay, Patrick. Good to speak to you, and good luck with your archive.